From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Coming soon to a hot gridiron near you, the NFL, ahead on Only a Game, a preseason preview, also a conversation with Marty Appel about his second Thurman Munson biography, and we celebrate the racing presidents, the exploding sausages, and the general incompetence of the bottom-dwelling Washington Nationals. Also ahead, garbage wranglers go head-to-head in the Solid Waste Association of North America's 11th annual Mid-Atlantic Rodeo.
You can do it, right, Meyer? You can do it. You can do it. You can do it.
Yeah!
Just don't hit that barricade, and I think you got the other dude by points.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It happens every year. Summer is cruising along, lots of swimming, barbecues, and trips to the ice cream stand, and then wham! Like a 300-pound defensive tackle coming from the blind side, it hits you. It's time for NFL training camps. Joining me now to discuss which teams should be optimistic and which should be pessimistic is Mike Freeman of CBSSportsLine.com. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the defending Super Bowl champions, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Are Ben Roethlisberger and company well-positioned to repeat?
Yeah, why not? They pretty much have everyone back. Their defense is as good as anyone's in the sport. The AFC overall is very top-heavy, and I think they're at the top. I think right now they're the best team in football, until proven otherwise. If I were them, I wouldn't be worrying too much about much right now.
Elsewhere in the AFC, although head coach Bill Belichick would never let on because he never lets on about anything, Tom Brady seems to have brought some high hopes with him having returned to the practice field in New England. What do you think? Will the Patriots get back to the top of the AFC East?
Well, with that coaching staff, they're always a threat. They're always going to be a legitimate Super Bowl contender because Bill Belichick is so good at what he does. We won't really know about Brady until the season starts. I mean, he looks fine now in practice. Preseason games, I'm sure he'll look fine because they don't do a whole lot. He won't play a whole lot. If he's even just 80-90%, they're going deep in the playoffs. He's the key to that franchise. Their defense is still a little iffy, but it's good enough to hang with any team in football. It all depends on Brady.
The New York Jets have had at least three player skirmishes during camp, and new head coach Rex Ryan is very happy about that. He even referred to the incidents as rock'em sock'em robots. Does this bode well for the Brett Favre-less Jets?
Boy, rock'em sock'em robots is very dated. You can tell Rex Ryan, he dated himself with that. But there are a lot of Jets fans really like him now because he's come in, he's said a few things, he's brash, he's energetic, but this is a Jets team that really doesn't have a top-notch number one receiver, may have a rookie starting at quarterback, has a solid defense but not great. I do like Ryan as a coach. I think he's going to be very good, but not yet. It's a little early for the Jets, just a little bit.
Turning to the NFC, the Arizona Cardinals were longer than a long shot to make it to the Super Bowl, never mind nearly win it. Can they find their way back to the big game?
When you lose in the Super Bowl, teams, for whatever reason, and there are a variety of reasons, but for whatever reason, they have a hard time getting back. And not only getting back, they have a hard time making the playoffs. And that's what Arizona's battling. It's a battling against history. I think Kurt Warner's a Hall of Famer, but he is older. And at what point will his age catch up to him? Will it be this year? Will it be next year? You just don't know. But that offense is still very explosive. So if they can overcome that curse, that's a 10-11 win team. But that curse, there's a reason why that's happened.
After years of flip-flopping between Rex Grossman and Kyle Orton, there's a new quarterback in Chicago. Will Jay Cutler take the Bears further than he ever took the Broncos?
I'm not a huge Cutler fan, only because I think he makes far too many mistakes. What helps him in Chicago is the defense is pretty solid, and he's got a great running game to rely on. The thing in the NFC is the NFC really is wide open. I can't really pick a favorite. If you look at teams like the Giants, they have weaknesses. Arizona, we've talked about. It's a very, very wide open conference. So there's no reason why Chicago can't get in there and do some damage.
The San Francisco 49ers have yet to sign their first-round draft pick, former Texas Tech wide receiver Michael Crabtree. Thursday, Crabtree's cousin and advisor, and that's always a good idea to have your advisor be your cousin, said the number 10 pick is considering sitting out this season and re-entering the draft in 2010. Is it ever a good idea to sit out the entire season when you're a draft pick?
Well, first of all, I love my cousins, but they're not advising me. As you said, not really a great idea having your cousin advise you. I've been covering the NFL for 20 years. It's a rarity. It happens, but it's still a rarity. Eugene Parker is a very good agent. I don't see that happening in this case. I think the guy will be in camp. I just think it'll be late. I think he'll sign this year.
Michael Vick has completed his sentence after his conviction on dogfighting charges. Vick is eligible to return to the National Football League, though he will have to sit out 4 games before playing. Which teams seem to you most likely to sign him?
If I was Michael Vick, I'd prepare for 2010. I don't know how much he's going to be able to help a team this year. Even though there's this just parade of teams saying they're not going to sign him, you can't rule out one of these top contenders, one of these really solid franchises. Even though I've sort of ruled out New England, you still can't rule them out completely. A team like the Packers, a team that has a very solid foundation with some very good coaches and strong ownership, a fan base that will follow them no matter what. You still can't rule out some of these top teams doing it, especially if there's an injury.
All right, Michael, I have to inform you now that only a game policy dictates that I must ask for your Super Bowl predictions, despite the fact that we're barely into August, so let them rip.
One of the teams I really like a lot this year from the AFC is Baltimore. I think they're primed to make a run here in the next 2-3 years, and I think it's going to start very, very soon. And I was very, very high on Philadelphia. They've taken some defensive hits. Sadly, their defensive coordinator, Jim Johnson, passed away. But I'll stick with that for now. How about that? Baltimore, Philadelphia.
All right, we'll have that tape queued up for you in December.
Oh, no, no, no. This tape will self-destruct in 60 seconds, all right?
Michael Freeman writes for CBSSportsLine.com. He is also the author of The All-Time Biggest Sports Jerks and Other Goofballs, Cads, Miscreants, Reprobates, and Weirdos, plus a Few Good Guys, published by Triumph Books. That's quite a title. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was fun.
Despite their recent winning streak, the Washington Nationals continue to be the least accomplished team in Major League Baseball by a lot. The other really bad teams in baseball have won at least 40 games, not the Nationals. Old friend Gabe O'Connor recently attended a game between Washington and the San Diego Padres, and he has this report on the bizarre on- and off-field charms of the Nats.
Are you ready for Friday night fireworks?
It's a beautiful night for fireworks. It's another rotten night for Washington Nationals fans. After a recent 6-2 loss to the horrible San Diego Padres, several thousand Nats fans enjoy bang-zoom-go-the-fireworks night at Nationals ballpark. There hasn't been much to enjoy this season. The Nats are the worst team in baseball by a wide margin. Tonight they commit 4 errors. The Nats lead the majors in that category. Their starting pitchers are terrible and their relievers are abysmal. They also lead the majors in blown saves. D.C. resident Court Swift savors a beer with his friends and takes the latest loss in stride.
Well, I think they're going to be better than this. But, I don't know, after the initial shock of how terrible they were, it's been more numbing than painful, I would say.
The beer helps a little.
Well, yeah.
Beer is just one of the many necessary diversions in a season full of ugly baseball and surreal Nationals headlines. In February, Sports Illustrated reported that top Dominican prospect, 19-year-old Smiley Gonzalez, to whom the Nats had given a $1.4 million signing bonus in 2006, was actually a 23-year-old named Carlos Lugo. A federal investigation of bonus skimming within the Nationals organization led to the resignation of general manager Jim Bowden the following month. The Nats kept their streak of futility going in April when they began their first homestand in uniforms that read Natnals and fined outfielder Elijah Dukes for being 5 minutes late to a game because he was signing autographs for Little Leaguers. During a game in June, fireworks debris landed on the district's fire chief, who was sitting in the stands. Right before the All-Star break in July, they fired manager Manny Acta. Just last week, the Nationals' beloved mascots, the Racing President, squared off against the Racing Pierogies of the Pittsburgh Pirates. The oversized Teddy Roosevelt was knocked out with a cross body block by an oversized pierogi named Oliver Onion. Despite the weirdness and incompetence, Nationals ballpark is surprisingly full tonight with 23,000 fans. Tim Titus is a season ticket holder who lives in nearby Arlington, Virginia. who grew up a Pirates fan and admits that he, like so many of the locals, doesn't root for the Nats.
But you also get to see some of the best players in the National League who come here from other teams. You know, I mean, there were a lot of people here last night thinking they'd see Albert Pujols, but he didn't play. So, but it's still a great place to spend a summer night. There's really no place I'd rather be than watching baseball.
You hear that answer a lot at Nationals Ballpark, where you're more likely to see fans wearing Giants jerseys or Red Sox caps than actual Nats gear. That's partly because almost everyone in the D.C. area is from somewhere else. They come out in force when their team comes to Washington. The Boston Red Sox came here for a three-game series, and each game set a Nationals ballpark attendance record at nearly 42,000. I asked genuine Nats fans Prue and Carl Nelson if they get frustrated when they see fans of other teams overrun National Ballpark. A full stadium, they say, is better than an empty one.
Yeah, even if they're rooting for the other team.
So it's a friendly, welcoming ballpark then.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, we like baseball. We come to see baseball.
Yeah.
Winning is secondary.
Well, it's been very secondary so far this year.
Tertiary.
Yeah.
Come on now, pay too much money. Give me something now. And make it good. Make it count.
Even if the winning remains tertiary, there are some fans like D.C. native Justin Green. With two outs in the ninth, he cheers as fans stream past him, hoping to beat the traffic or the crowds clogging the metro trains. He's also waiting for his girlfriend to finish her shift at the ballpark. But he'd be here anyways.
This stadium is actually like my baby. I live right across the bridge in Southeast, and I watched them build this stadium brick by brick. You understand what I'm saying? So when I had my chance to get here, I was going to get here every day, all the time. Even if we, like we are, losing like hell, man. I'm sorry, but we had, you know. I got to be here.
Sadly for the bumbling Nationals, Green is a rare example of a loyal local fan. Asked D.C. resident Mike Frizzell, originally a Tigers fan, how long it would take for someone to take a pair of free Nationals tickets off his hands.
It might take a little while. But there's a lot of tickets available right now.
And for the foreseeable future, unless of course the Red Sox are in town. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Washington, D.C.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Last Sunday's attempt at Southend-on-Sea in Essex, England, to set the bikini record failed. Failed utterly. Perhaps in part because Saturday's weather was poor, on Sunday only 42 women in bikinis showed up at the designated beach. As a result, the brave quest fell 1,881 bikini-clad women short of the record set in Russia last year, where 1,923 women in two-piece bathing suits temporarily gathered. Said Debbie Reynolds, who was one of the 42 women who did appear Sunday at Southend-on-Sea, "It's pretty rubbish, I must admit. It made me pretty embarrassed to be British when we can't even mount a decent challenge."
With a hot dog and a surf at the beach,
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, images of athletes mature enough to remember Jim Thorpe and Babe Zaharias. But first, last Sunday marked the 30th anniversary of the death of former New York Yankees catcher Thurman Munson. Munson was 32 when he crashed the jet he'd recently purchased. He was practicing takeoffs and landings near his home in Canton, Ohio. Marty Appel, who wrote a biography of the catcher when he was starring with the Yankees in the late 70s, has now written a much more ambitious and complete treatment of Thurman Munson's life and death. Marty Appel joins me now from NPR New York. Marty, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's good to be on with you, Bill.
You got to know Thurman Munson when you were the public relations director for the Yankees in the 70s. What led you to revisit the subject about which you'd written 33 years ago?
Just the feeling that someday the full story should be told, because he held so much back in the autobiography project in the 70s. Of all things, when we approached the topic, he just said, does it have to be personal, which is quite an odd question for an autobiography.
When he'd read that first book, Thurman Munson told you that he wished it could have been funnier. So I'd like to give you the opportunity to tell at least one funny story from the current book. Tell us about the night that Billy Martin, the Yankees manager, caught Munson in George Steinbrenner's shower.
Thurman really liked Billy, but didn't like the pressure that he was under working for Mr. Steinbrenner. And it was his intention to go to Mr. Steinbrenner's hotel suite and say, look, either fire him or leave him alone. You're making him crazy. Billy Martin arrived late on the same floor of that hotel and heard the voices in the room and just knocked on the door and demanded to come in. Thurman was actually with Lou Piniella, and the two of them just ran and hid like children in the bathroom behind the shower curtain.
It's priceless to think of Major League ball players running in and hiding behind the shower curtain.
It is.
To what extent did the development of Thurman Munson begin the resurgence of those Yankees of the 70s?
People look back now on the late 60s, early 70s as a time of awful mediocrity in the Yankees franchise. They were the years that CBS owned the team, and they just really weren't putting any players on the roster that would make you get interested in the team. Mickey Mantle retired in 1968. The catcher was a converted third baseman named Jake Gibbs, and the team was in desperate need of somebody who was going to lead them to greater heights. Munson, an All-American catcher in Kent State, was available to the Yankees in the first round of the 1968 draft. They selected him, and at once we all knew this guy was going to be a leader and he was going to be our starting catcher almost immediately.
A lot of baseball fans who didn't root for the Yankees probably remember Thurman Munson as a scrappy, often belligerent guy who didn't much like the writers and who resented the fact that Boston's Carlton Fisk got more attention than Munson did. Would people who recall the Yankee catcher that way be wrong?
They would be absolutely correct. People think the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry goes back forever, but it really didn't take the shape of what we know it as today until Thurman came along in 1970 and Fisk in 72, both rookies of the year and both key parts of their respective lineups. Thurman resented all the attention Fisk was getting in those early years because Carlton was so often on the disabled list and was sort of receiving accolades for things that might have been. Thurman never was on the disabled list once in his entire career. He admired durability and playing when hurt. And yet Fisk would win the All-Star voting every year, and Thurman thought that Kurt Gowdy was talking him up on the game of the week too much. So there was a genuine dislike that grew between the two of them.
After his death, there was some discussion in the investigation of the accident that Thurman Munson was too overtired to fly a plane on that day. Tell us about the circumstances leading up to the crash.
He had flown home on his own from Chicago after the Yankees concluded a series there with the intent of spending the day with his family, and he was doing that. He had spent the morning with his children. He had lunch with his father-in-law, and then he was going to reconvene with his wife to meet with civic leaders about renaming a street for him in Canton. So he was on the go, and he was active, and there was no sign of fatigue in him. But the reality was he did only have 3 hours of sleep, and in a plane like the Cessna Citation, you have to be at top alert. There's no margin for error there.
In one of the most uncomfortable moments in your book, you relate what Thurman Munson's father had to say at the catcher's funeral in 1979. Set that scene for us.
He was so estranged from the family that no one even knew if he was dead or alive. But he did show up at the funeral in Canton, Ohio, coming from his home in Arizona. Thurman had 3 older siblings, all of whom had left home right after high school, and they were shocked to see him. His father arrived at the Civic Center where the funeral was being held and promptly called a press conference for all the New York media to tell them that he was, in fact, a better player than Thurman was and that Thurman had just gotten all the breaks. It was a very uncomfortable scene for everyone. An hour later, at the actual burial at the cemetery, his father walked up to the grave and said, "You always thought you were too big for this world, huh? Well, look who's still standing." At which point he was escorted off.
Shortly after his death, there was a movement to make the same exception for Thurman Munson that had been made for Roberto Clemente, that is, suspend the 5-year waiting period, put him right into the Hall of Fame. That didn't happen, and Thurman Munson never was elected to the Hall of Fame. Should he have been?
I don't think so. People would, I think, like for me to say that he should be a Hall of Famer as his biographer and add a little emphasis to that. But I'm a purist when it comes to the Hall of Fame, and Thurman's plaque would require an asterisk saying this is what might have been. And when, in essence, he was injured, even though severely, the most severe possible, but he was injured on his way to Cooperstown, and there are more of those than there are people who go to Cooperstown.
Having gone back and reevaluated Thurman Munson's career and his life for this book, what do you think his legacy as a ballplayer is?
Well, I think it's fascinating the way he had a contentious relationship with the media, so he didn't get great press, as they say, and yet the fans couldn't care less. He could do anything. He could give them the traditional obscene gesture on the field, and they were all forgiving. He was a fan's player, and they saw around the bad press, and they adopted him as a winner who was going to take the Yankees to greater glory, and they just loved the guy, and that it still exists to this day when you see all the middle-aged, slightly overweight men wearing their Munson T-shirts at Yankee Stadium.
Marty Appel is the author of Munson, The Life and Death of a Yankee Captain, published by Doubleday, and he joined me from NPR in New York. Marty, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In a corridor on the ground floor of the Aberjonah Rehabilitation and Nursing Center in Winchester, Massachusetts, John Rich and I are looking at an exhibit of his photographs. Among them is the image of Lorette Rindlob, 73, who is rowing on the Swampscott River in Exeter, New Hampshire.
I think she liked being photographed. A lot of these people, and not just Lorette, toil in obscurity, as it were. They're not in the popular culture, they're not in magazines or in billboards in Times Square, and they enjoyed the attention, basically.
Some of the subjects in the photographs John Rich is showing me as we walk down the corridor are runners, and some are swimmers. A couple are competitive tennis players, and most of these athletes, who are not in their 70s or their 80s, are over 90. Rich, who began noticing older athletes when he found himself competing with them in 10K races, has titled the 20 images Miles to Go.
One of my favorites is this guy right here, Al Puma. Al Puma was 77 when I photographed him a couple of years ago, and he is a stair-climbing champion. He, in his age group, has won the Empire State Building run-up. And right after I took his picture and interviewed him, within a couple of months, he sent me a photograph of himself, his daughter, and his granddaughter, and they had just competed in a sprint triathlon as a team.
Fantastic.
He did the bike part, his daughter did the run, and his granddaughter did the swim.
The official opening of Miles to Go, which occurred at the end of June, was in some respects no different from the opening night of a photography exhibit at any gallery would have been. This was no surprise, since for several years this portion of the Aberjonah Rehab and Nursing Center has been functioning as one of several satellite galleries for the Griffin Museum of Photography in Winchester, so there were refreshments available in what's normally the exercise room, and a couple of the athletes pictured in John Rich's photographs were on hand for the festivities.
I started jogging when I was 44, and I felt great. It really made me feel good. And the kids suggested I start running with them when I was 62.
Your kids?
Yeah, so I did.
Bill Stern is now 90. He still runs every day. In one of the photographs in the exhibit, he's standing in his home office before a wall covered with awards he has won. He explained to me with a smile that the awards actually cover 3 walls of that room, but that a lot of his running has been recreational rather than competitive.
I mean, for many years, whenever a lot of business travel, always take my shoes, shorts, and a shirt. And I've run in Hyde Park in London. I've run in Paris and everywhere you go.
So that's sort of how you get to know a city.
At 6 o'clock in the morning in New York City, in Central Park, you can see 6,000 runners. Beautiful.
It was impossible, especially in the corridor of a rehabilitation and nursing center, to avoid the idea that Bill Stern and the other athletes John Rich had photographed might serve as an inspiration to residents and patients, a notion that Mr. Stern said he found gratifying.
It is. I try to help everybody I can.
No worries that somebody will see this and say, darn, that guy's lucky. He's got great genes. He can go out and do that.
Well, that's very important that you choose your parents properly.
Down the corridor from the photographs of Bill Stern, there were two images of Louise Wing, the synchronized swimmer who turned 90 3 weeks ago. The photograph of Wing in the water especially impressed Rhoda Treach.
Oh, such life. Such vitality. In the water, this woman looks as if she's really coming alive. And that little impish grin. And her eyes. I mean, I would like my eyes to look like that, you know, in 5 years.
Seated near the refreshments table, Louise Wing herself smiled at the idea that a photograph of her might have encouraged not only women who are much younger than she is, but also patients at the rehabilitation center.
I think it's great. I mean, I've spent last year in rehab of one kind or another, so I know how they feel.
Wing has been recovering from a stroke. Though she still swims, she has acknowledged that her most competitive days may have passed.
Well, of course, in competition, we have some really good swimmers in the 80 to 89 group, which I used to win all the time, but now they've moved on ahead of me, and that's all right.
Louise Wing expressed satisfaction that the photographs of her were hanging beside the runners, tennis players, and rowers of her generation. Equally pleased with the exhibit was Rebecca Elkins, the administrator of the Aberjonah Rehabilitation and Nursing Center, who has sometimes found herself in the corridor while patients have been on the way to their rehab appointments.
Basically, I've heard a lot of like exclamations like, wow, look what that person did. How old is that person? I can't believe that. And, you know, a lot of people saying, I was worried about, you know, getting my hip done and recovering from that. Look at what this person did. And a lot of things like that. I mean, it's been wonderful. It really has been wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Great response.
Miles to Go will continue to be exhibited at the Griffin Museum Satellite Gallery at the Aberjonah Rehabilitation and Nursing Center in Winchester, Massachusetts, through September 6th. You're listening to Only a Game. In our most recent letters segment, I read an email that begged as follows, please, no more soccer. This week, Kim Prentice, a WBUR listener, emailed to say, please offer more reports on soccer, especially women's soccer. So, you see the dilemma we face. Along similar lines, Victoria Deke, who hears the program on WFYI in Indianapolis, wrote as follows, it seems you are not aware that there is a professional league that is currently playing. It's called the WNBA. Although I love hearing about wrestling, cricket at all, perhaps you could spare 30 seconds for this exciting game. And so we will soon. Last week in our conversation, Charlie Pierce and I discussed the new high-tech swimsuits in use at the World Aquatic Championships. Charlie said they were no different than the high-tech poles that had changed pole vaulting. Nancy Harrison, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore, and Thomas Puckelnick, who hears Only a Game on WCPN in Cleveland, were among the listeners who took issue with that comparison. The most concise response to Charlie's contention came from Sherm Grossman. Note to Charlie, he wrote, you can't pole vault without a pole, but you can swim without a suit. That's the difference. Fair enough, though the attempt to swim without a suit might not sit well with at least some of the members of FINA, Swimming's World Organizing Body. In response to the revelation that David Ortiz, known to lots of admiring fans as Big Poppy, was on the list of ballplayers who had tested positive for performance-enhancing substances back in 2003, Eric Edlund sent a thoughtful email. It is not acceptable to say that it is enough that we laughed and enjoyed the games and found inspiration in a cheat, but hey, so what, he wrote. However much it shames us, either Ortiz should be cast out or we must face the facade of our disbelief. And finally, John Poole and George Chapman, both of whom hear Only a Game on KSUT in Ignacio, Colorado, wrote to suggest that although the athletes competing in the Vermont 100 endurance run, about which Doug Trabu reported last week, were admirable, we really should report on the even more challenging Hard Rock 100 endurance run, which requires, according to Mr. Poole, the equivalent of running to the top of Mount Everest and back. Without nearly that much effort, you can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our mailing address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon. The world of news encompasses a multitude of subjects, which is why Ron Rappaport often joins me to talk about sports on Weekend Edition. You can also count on Weekend Edition to bring you political, business, and cultural news from around the non-sports world. Join Ron and me for Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
Norman Laker, the South African gentleman who coaches India's rugby team, has decided that in order to improve, the players must eat more. The players have three meals a day, and that's not enough, Mr. Laker said recently. In South Africa, elite rugby players have seven meals a day. India's team is rated 83rd of the 95 teams ranked by the International Rugby Board, and Coach Laker has suggested some tips that will help his club close the gap between India and South Africa, currently ranked first in the world. I have told them they must eat at least 15 eggs a day, six for breakfast and the remaining nine anytime, anyhow. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Ride 'em Teamster. Yeehaw! But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends in Florida, both at WJUF in Inverness, Florida, and WUFT not far from the swamp in Gainesville.
There you
chomp,
go.
Chomp.
We have a new, most lavishly compensated NFL player this week, Charlie. Eli Manning signed a contract extension with the New York Giants that's worth $97 million over the next half dozen years. Good investment?
Well, all of my football friends are rather baffled by this. I mean, let's face facts. The man is not even the best quarterback at the annual Thanksgiving dinner table in his house. But right place, right time. He would have been a free agent next year. He's already got a Super Bowl for the Giants. It would have been impossible to lose him, so I guess they see it's a fairly good investment.
Speaking of the Thanksgiving dinner table that you just mentioned, how long before Colts quarterback Peyton Manning, Eli's brother, quietly suggests that he and Indianapolis should perhaps renegotiate?
Oh, what's today? I think probably half past a week and a half. Maybe 2 weeks, because it is his brother, after all.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced this week that benefits for retired players will not be affected during the upcoming labor dispute. Various interested parties interpreted that announcement as evidence that the commissioner is trying to break the players' union. Are they being paranoid?
Well, both sides are maneuvering to get the former players on their side in what looks like it's going to become a labor bloodbath. Were I a retired player, and were I experienced in how completely disposable management feels the players are in this sport, I would be sort of leaning on the side of the union myself.
The president of the Pro Football Writers Association, Charian Williams, said this week, quote, "It would be a shame for a beat writer to get beaten on a story by a 12-year-old in the stands." Why should Mr. Williams be worried about that possibility?
Well, because players are apparently overly tweeting from various parts of the field, the locker room, the bench, under the stands with whatever young lady they met at halftime, could possibly be about anything. And, of course, this would bypass the usual chain of information that exists at sporting events. So football writers are opposed to it. Teams are cracking down on it. Another problem Vince Lombardi never had.
Okay, here's my candidate for sports trivia question this week. We learned that the Arena Football League is dead, not just asleep. What rock musician owned the last team to win a championship in the Arena Football League?
This might baffle you because the team is called the Philadelphia Soul, and the rocker in question, John Bon Jovi, anyway, owned the Philadelphia Soul. I will miss arena football. I covered arena football in its infancy in Providence, Rhode Island, almost 20 years ago. It was a great cheap take for the family. It was goofy as all get out, and I will miss it.
The long wait is over, Charlie. Today, Red Sox slugger David Ortiz and incoming Players Union head Michael Weiner will hold a news conference to explain Ortiz's 2003 positive test for performance-enhancing drugs. Do you expect Big Poppy's announcement to be illuminating?
I'll wait for the book to come out, actually. I mean, nothing he says is going to satisfy the people for whom this drug frenzy is a major scandal. As I pointed out last week, a conscientious objector in the whole war on drugs. I'll be interested to read what he says. I won't have any illusions about anyone believing it.
Baseball is a pastoral game, of course, lyrical as well, except when Prince Fielder of the Milwaukee Brewers charges through the tunnels of Dodger Stadium with mayhem against the pitcher who hit him on his mind, as he did on Tuesday night. Do you think Major League Baseball's response was appropriate?
They were fine. They weren't suspended. I think they like fiery players. I don't think they like it carrying over into charging the locker room. Charging the pitcher is one thing. Charging the locker room is altogether another.
Yeah, charging the opponent's dugout is apparently forgiven in baseball. Throwing a baseball into the stands, however, is not. Julio Castillo, a minor league pitcher, was sentenced to 30 days in jail and 3 years probation for throwing a ball that hit a fan who suffered a concussion as a consequence of that. Does baseball welcome Mr. Castillo back?
I hope so. 30 days in jail even seems a bit much for this, but it's like the penalty is always worse for a boxer who gets in a bar brawl. The penalty is worse for a professional thrower of baseballs who throws it into the stands.
In NBA news, on Thursday, Orlando Magic forward Rashard Lewis was suspended for 10 games for an elevated testosterone level. He will also be docked $1.6 million. This is an expensive way to learn that probably you should read the ingredient label on whatever you buy.
This is the first shoe to drop in the NBA, by the way, in this entire situation. It's been relatively unexamined over the past few years. Players have been getting bigger. As we know, that's all you need for suspicion. As I said, this is the first shoe to drop in the NBA, I think.
A federal judge's ruling this week may have made it more likely that Delaware will be able to institute a sports betting lottery at some point in the near future. Are we headed for a day when anybody anywhere can legally bet on any sport and local and national governments will get a piece of that action?
Yes, we are. It will be fought on every level by every sports league. For example, Delaware can now forget about hosting the Final Four. But sooner or later, the NCAA is going to find itself surrounded. They're either going to have every championship in their offices in Indianapolis, or they're going to have to make peace with this.
We got a lesson this week on what happens when a landlocked country defends its America's Cup title in a very, very large boat. Could you please explain how the Swiss team, Alinghi, got its catamaran to Italy?
Well, the same way Hannibal got there. Hannibal used elephants. These guys used a helicopter. And I wish we were doing video because the picture of the helicopter carrying the catamaran over the Alps is worth the price of admission.
The head of the fan club of the Russian national soccer team told fans not to worry about contracting the so-called swine flu while traveling to Wales to support their team in next month's World Cup qualifier. What do you think of Mr. Alexander Shabergin's
prophylactic advice.
Gee, it's hard to imagine a Russian coming up with this one, but he advises the supporters to drink a lot of what he calls, quote-unquote, Welsh whiskey, which I've never heard of, actually.
Me neither.
I've heard of Scotch and Irish, but never Welsh whiskey. It sounds formidable and without vowels.
Perhaps you haven't heard of it because it's a medicine rather than a libation. And finally, knowing how much you appreciate a good world record, I leave it to you to reveal which record Sam the Bubble Man is preparing to break. And gee, I sure hope I haven't given it away.
37 years old, Sam Heath is trying to make the world's, and I have to get this right because we don't want to deprive Sam of his distinction, the world's record for largest free-floating soap bubble by volume.
Mm.
He's attempting to break the record that was set in Minnesota almost 5 years ago, which was a volume of 105.4 cubic feet. And may I say just again, sports!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His new book, widely celebrated and selling quickly, so get yours now, is Idiot America. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Our new friends in Florida are so baffled.
Sports, Charlie asks, and you may agree that he has a point. The creation of soap bubbles, even the quasi-competitive creation of really big soap bubbles, may not be basketball, baseball, hockey, tennis, or even golf. But on the eve of the time of the year when millions of people will be paying a great deal of attention to college and pro football, a nod to the man setting the world record for creation of the largest soap bubble seems to me appropriate. I would similarly defend and have similarly defended skillet tossing, wife carrying, underwater rugby, belt sander racing, and high pointing, in which people tramp up hillocks in places like Rhode Island so they can say they have climbed as high as they can in each state. Are these activities silly? That's at least part of the point. In a land where the men in charge of adolescent football players are paid millions of dollars and control staffs of dozens of grim assistants, a land where humorless coaches of pro teams accuse each other of surveillance and treachery and look the other way while their players dose themselves with chemicals better suited for horses, sometimes, in self-defense, we need to celebrate a bigger bubble. It's rodeo season. This being radio, you might not realize the story we're about to hear concerns a rodeo that's spelled R-O-A-D-E-O. From Penn Argyll, Pennsylvania, Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports on an event where riders compete on wheels and all of them talk trash.
It's 7:30 a.m. on a sticky June Friday, and the fog hasn't quite lifted from the football field-sized parking lot at the Penn Argyll landfill. That's where more than 60 drivers in orange day-glow vests are poised to put the pedal to the metal in all manner of garbage truck. Officials in the registration tent sort out last-minute glitches.
And the bags are right there. You want to grab one of those? Hats and shirts are next door.
They got me scheduled for real low, but I'm a recycle driver.
You know, I wish they would have registered you right, because we only had two recycle drivers.
While on the track, they mull an earlier start time for one driver who couldn't get the day off.
There's a guy that has to run his route?
He has to run his route in Dunmore. He said it was the only way they'd let him compete.
Welcome to the 11th annual Mid-Atlantic Rodeo, a rite of summer for anyone who hauls trash in these parts or handles it once it gets to the dump. The participants come from New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland. They've already won local competitions sponsored by SWANA, the Solid Waste Association of North America, which has more than 150 chapters. And they're hoping to advance to SWANA's national finals, set for September in Largo, Florida. But first, they'll have to run an obstacle course that amounts to the driving test from hell.
What we're going to do right now is walk through the course. The judge that's responsible for judging each event will explain his portion of it.
The trip begins with two sets of parallel barricades, scarcely wider than a garbage truck, which will have to exit the first set with a sharp left turn and an immediate right in order to fit through the second set. That maneuver is followed at the end of the parking lot by a rolling right turn through 50 feet of closely spaced traffic cones. Further along, a parking station awaits, with barricades at the front and rear that leave little room for error.
Parallel park, you have 3 minutes. It's the same as if there's a building here and you're trying to fit in. Point deductions. If you're over 24 inches from the curb, there's no score. If you put your bumper over the curb while you're trying to parallel park, there's no score.
There are three more challenges, most notably the serpentine, a tight slalom course which drivers must navigate forward and backward. During a test run, veteran rodeo driver David Carmen demonstrates how he handles the serpentine in reverse.
Okay, there I am. I'm past the first cone. I got the second cone in my back mirror, so I'm starting to spin the wheel to get around, and I'm still cutting the wheel hard to make it back through the last one, which I don't think I'm going to do this time. Where'd it go? Where'd it go? Where'd it go? There it is. And made it.
To Talbert Woodall, a first-time entrant from Atlantic City, the twists and turns of the course mirror his daily experience.
If someone parks right at the tip of the alleyway and you need to get out, you have to make sure that you don't, you know, nip either the rear end of the bumper or the front end of the bumper. So, I mean, it's what's going on out there in the real world. You know, you have people that may be in a blind spot, which would play as a cone, and you have to make sure that you don't run over the cone because that could be either a child or a car or someone on a bike or anything.
There are four categories in the garbage truck competition, starting with the backloaders used by most residential trash collectors to the front loaders, side loaders, and tractor trailers that pick up dumpsters. Although there's a time limit for each stage, the scoring is based on accuracy rather than speed. Hitting any obstacle, missing a required maneuver, or having to back up and try again all result in deductions.
We're good to go.
Okay.
Good luck.
Driver Brian Stahl, in the bright white garbage truck provided by the host landfill, leads off the rear loader competition and makes more of a mess than the ones he's used to cleaning up. Stahl hits barricades, savages the cones on the rolling right turn, and knocks over the slalom markers on the serpentine as a Greek chorus of fellow drivers offers critiques.
He was too confident. He made it. He went through too fast without checking. You know what I mean? Too fast. I'd be going in first gear. You know, he's got it in drive.
After finishing the course, Stahl explains that he's been accident-free for the past 16 years, but despite that record, was intimidated in his first rodeo.
I'm nervous. Being the first guy, different truck, and I got everybody watching you.
The sideline commentary becomes more personal as Carol Reitmeyer watches her husband Jerry take his turn on the course.
You can do it, Reitmeyer. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, he missed one.
Just don't hit that barricade, and I think you got the other dude by points. Stop. Stop, Jerry. Okay. All right.
Next is the front loader competition. That's the kind of garbage truck which lifts dumpsters over its front end and empties them into the back. Stephen Everett, a two-time winner in this event, says that the drivers of these trucks are accorded elite status.
It takes more skills because you interact with buildings and you're backing into alleys, overhead wires, obstructions, trees. Whereas like residential, they're just up and down the street.
Not to mention that front loaders have a tighter turning radius, which Everett used to advantage in winning yet another regional title. But there's more to the rodeo than garbage trucks. About a half mile away, yellow bulldozers, dump trucks, and oversized compactors, capable of reducing a ton of trash to a single cubic yard, navigate their own barrel-studded course. These vehicles usually take over when the garbage arrives at this 435-acre site. But today, says organizer and judge Scott Perrin, they're part of the competition.
You know, the whole idea was to give these guys a chance to come out here and show what they could do against each other. And obviously, everybody thinks they're probably the best heavy equipment operator out here, but you don't know until you get with guys from other sites.
Or the gals. Jane Lesher from Morgantown, Pennsylvania, is today's only female competitor.
Everybody's talking to me. I'm talking to everybody else, you know, and giving each other pointers and different, you know, things, you know. And at work, you know, I'm like one of the guys. That's what they say at work, you know. I'm one of the guys.
In just her first rodeo, Lesher took first in the dump truck division. She plans to compete at the SWANA National Finals in Florida. And then there's Roque Espinoza, the driver who couldn't get off from work today. He finished third in the recycled truck division and made it back in time to Dunmore, Pennsylvania, to complete his appointed rounds. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jim Kiesling ably filled in for him this week. Our intern is Josh Levenshurz. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view my Miles to Go photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from rodeo driver Jerry Reitmeier. Hey, Reitmeier, I'm right behind you. Look out. Oh, gee, backed over my Peabody Award. Now, people will never believe I got one. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Of course I don't know if I do. I'm about to wipe it out here with you. I take a lover's leave with you.
Call you a lover boy. Try it! Pick it up.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.